Good morning. And welcome back for week two of a planned four. I am grateful to all those who responded to my poll about the temperature. Those who said it was fine, those who said it was too cold, the minority who said it was too hot. The upshot of all of it being that I hope it's better today, but I'm sure I can look forward to emails afterwards, you know, advising. Last week we started out by talking about the origins of Kabbalah. We talked about the meaning of the word. We said Kabbalah is a received tradition. We talked about the goals of this tradition, trying to explain, as I put it, the wiring behind the wall, how the universe works, the connection between human being and God, the connection between God and the world in general. We talked about what makes this different from philosophy and said that in philosophy you debate and you argue and you make logical statements, whereas within Kabbalah it's really a received tradition. It's not something which is up for negotiation. It is up for analysis. There are still conclusions that can be drawn, ideas that can be learned, and new statements that can be made. Nonetheless, what it's not up for in the same way is a person's creation of his own idea and to say, I would like to add this to Kabbalah. That part of it would mean it may be a nice philosophical idea, but it's not Kabbalah. Kabbalah, by definition, is something that has been received. We talked about how this received tradition has a funny relationship with Torah, in the sense that it's part of Torah, in that the great teachers of Kabbalah historically were experts in Torah. A lot of it involves explaining biblical passages, Talmudic passages, specific mitzvot, And in that sense, it's part of Torah. On the other hand, the ideas of Kabbalah often do not have a clear anchor in biblical text. It doesn't come through the standard sources for explanation of biblical text. It doesn't go through the vetting process, peer review, so to speak, of debate in the Beit Midrash. And so that causes a degree of confusion about it. Is it Torah? Is it not Torah? Is studying Torah considered a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Torah study? Can sources of Kabbalah influence the evolution of Jewish law? All of those result from this sort of in-between status that the information of Kabbalah has. We then ask, well, if Kabbalah doesn't have the pedigree of the Beit Midrash, if it wasn't discussed down through the ages out in the open, then why does it have any credibility at all? Why don't we view it as some outside tradition that some would wish to insert within Torah? To which the answer that I offered is that when you look back as early as biblical text, you see there is something mystical going on. There is something going on, some conveying of information about God, about what God wants, about the world, that isn't explicit at all in biblical text. Some of it in terms of mitzvot. We pointed out that Noah seems to have information about kosher and non-kosher animals, even though the Torah isn't going to say anything about it until long after he's gone. The biblical verse about Abraham observing all of God's mitzvot and commandments also seems to imply that. The idea that Abraham and Sarah are converting people to something, what exactly are they converting them to? Beyond the basic idea of monotheism, what else is there? And the mystics contend that this religion of Abraham and Sarah, of Abraham and Sarah, actually is this drawing close to God that mysticism offers, that Kabbalah offers. And we noted a little bit about how this then shows up further along in the Talmud, and that's really where we left off. We were going to start talking about what happens after the Talmud and how that evolves into what people today think of as Kabbalah. So we noted that it isn't until the 10th century that you start to see books of Kabbalah develop. Someone asked me after the class last week, so what is Kabbalah? After all that we said in terms of its origins and what it's trying to accomplish, what is it? Well, if you ask that question in the 9th century, the answer is a body of information passed down by particular scholars within small groups geared towards explaining the deeper relationship between God and the universe. That's it. There would be no library you could point to. There would be no text you could refer them to and say, well, just read this. This is your book of Kabbalah. Didn't have it. It was really just teacher and student, or possibly small group of students, although we saw the Talmud already say that you're not supposed to really engage in its study in groups. It's really supposed to be one-on-one with a student who's already advanced enough to come up with ideas and draw conclusions independently. Joanna?
My question is, why would the young friends be discouraged from studying Kabbalah?
Right. Right, so that goes back to the point that we made towards the end last time, which is that the number one is the question of its pedigree, because it hasn't been part of the Beit Midrash debate. Are you sure this is authentic? That's one concern. You need to have a certain expertise of your own built up by years of study. And then the other is because Kabbalah says, and we're going to talk about this more this week as well, Kabbalah says some very strange things. Strange, when I say strange, I mean foreign things. Things that are foreign to sort of traditional Judaism when you talk about God. And when you talk about the way God runs the universe. And again, we're going to come back to it this week, but I think I mentioned an example last week, that when you look at Kabbalistic traditions about God, it talks about different aspects of God in ways that that portray God as, on the one hand, potentially male, on the other hand, potentially female. It lends itself to an idea of even multiple gods. And someone who's reading it without sophistication, as well as, frankly, without a certain degree of stability in terms of their life and their family situation and so forth, could very well take it and run with it in a direction that doesn't fit traditional Judaism. And so that was a major concern. So part of it is concern for being able to verify the authenticity of it, and part of it is being able to absorb what Kabbalah is trying to say without ending up with something that actually wouldn't look like Judaism in the end. So you want somebody to have a certain degree of stability and knowledge of Torah, and stability in terms of life experience, the stage that they're at in life. We are less concerned about somebody in their 40s and 50s, married with children, deciding that they're now the Messiah and starting a new movement, than we are with somebody who is a teenager and who, you know, has the world in front of them and is not anchored to anything. So aside from the knowledge base, there's a certain life stability that was sought as well. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Question or? Okay. So it isn't until the 10th century that you start to see the publicly available books. There are scrolls available, you know, within these schools that are studying themselves, but you do not have published books until you get to the 10th century. Yeah, I should note, I don't think I made a point of this last week, but it's really worth noting, the fact that they're not publishing things beforehand is not at all strange, even if you take away the secretive aspect of Kabbalah. When was the Talmud recorded? We've discussed this before, some of us. So the first part of the Talmud to be recorded is not until the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. The year 220 is when the Mishnah is first published. They keep the verbal tradition that explains biblical text private, not published for the world, until then, for a variety of very good reasons. One reason, and we can make a whole class out of this, and we've discussed it, some of us, on other occasions, but one reason is because when you keep something verbal, then you make sure people will convey it. It isn't simply on a shelf somewhere. I have a brother I like to use as my example. He's an accountant. And I once asked him, said, do you know what the tax code has to say about such and such a case? And he said, no, I can look it up. He doesn't actually need to know. He knows where to look in order to answer the question. Right? I have on the shelf here, let's say, I have Maimonides' Code of Law, and I know that if I have a question about prayer, I can open this up, and it will present me with what Maimonides has to say about the laws of prayer. I don't need to memorize it. That's fine if what you're dealing with is just a general code of law. Right? If that's all you're looking for is a general code of law, good. But if you want this to be a living body of information that affects the way people conduct their affairs on a day-to-day basis, it's not good enough for it to be in a book. And so what you do is you keep it verbal. And that way, it will be lived. It will be something that people have as part of themselves, as part of their knowledge base on an ongoing basis. That's one reason. Another reason why they specifically kept it verbal is that it ensures that people... I should really put this back on the shelf. Is to ensure that it will be flexible. It will be available to deal with new situations. Constitutional law in every country that has a constitution constantly wrestles with the question of originalism, right? What did the founders mean? Do I have to go back to their text? Or how do I apply it to circumstances today? Should I change it? What would they say if they saw what we're dealing with? So if you're in a world in which the only way Torah is studied is teacher to student, then the student gets to ask the teacher the question, what about this circumstance? If you're in a world in which people study from books, then you have to think it through yourself. Well, this book was written by somebody who was dealing 50 years ago in this circumstance, but now things have changed. What do we do now? So keeping it verbal means it will respond better to new circumstances. And that's a second reason. A third reason is simply protection. When you're living under enemy governments, as Jews did for much of their history, or not even enemy governments, but when you live in a society in which there are people who are hostile to you, you keep your information to yourself. It can only be studied by a teacher teaching it to a student, as opposed to writing it down where they can have access to it, they can corrupt it, they can take out pieces and use them to attack, and so forth. So for those and more reasons, it makes sense to keep a verbal tradition, and that's the way that it originally worked. You had your biblical text, and then you had your verbal explanation, and it's actually considered on the level of a mitzvah to keep it verbal. The problem is that we ran into two challenges. Challenge number one being human frailty. People forget. And problem number two being the Romans, who decreed that if anybody was caught teaching Torah, they would murder the teacher of Torah and they would murder the students. If anyone was caught ordaining a rabbi who would then go on to teach, they would murder the ordainee, the rabbinical court that ordained, and the Jewish community of the nearest town. Well, once you eliminate teachers, how are people going to learn? You need books. And so the sages ultimately said, we have to write it down, because if we don't write it down, we're stuck. And they began by writing down the outline of the Mishnah. There were certain other things that were already being written down, blessings and prayers, for example. But basically, it starts with the Mishnah, which is published in Israel, in the city of Tzipori, in the beginning of the 3rd century. It's right near the Kinneret. They have a great museum there, very worth visiting. And then the expanded version called the Gemara, which discusses the Mishnah, and that is completed with the Talmud in the 6th century, Common Era. So when you realize that even mainstream Jewish text doesn't really show up until Mishnah and Gemara, Talmud being completed in the 6th century, it's not strange at all that Kabbalah is going to be transmitted in this also verbal way without big published texts that are going to be available to the world. It isn't, as I said, until the 10th century, really, that it shows up. And that's when, I think I started to mention this last week, Rabbi Sadia Gaon, leader of the Jews in Babylon and from there far beyond, in the 10th century, he publishes a commentary to Sefer Yetzirah, the book of creation. And we start to get a sense of what's in this book, which we already saw was referred to in the Talmud, but no one actually had a copy of it publicly available until you hit the 10th century. In the 12th century, you find the Sefer Bahir. Bahir, anyone know what Bahir means in Hebrew? Clear, something that is clear, right? Is a good. So that's a work of deep mysticism on Bereshit, the book of creation, on the Hebrew alphabet and the significance of its letters, the significance of the different vowels that we use to pronounce Hebrew. All of that is in the Bahir. It's published in Provence in the year 1174, but is attributed to Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana, who's a sage of the Talmud back in the first century. And then the big one is the Zohar. And the Zohar is written, well, in part, it's organized as a commentary to the Chumash, but it's actually much more than that. It's attributed to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai of the 2nd century, but it's not published until the 13th century by Moses de Leon. with a lot of immediate discussion when it comes out of, well, who actually is the author? Is this for real? Is this really going back to Talmudic times, to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai? Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is a great name to use if you're going to claim that it's mystical, because Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, on the run from the Romans, lives in a cage. I mentioned in a cave. I mentioned it last week. For a dozen years. And when he emerges, he can't relate to day-to-day life. He sees people plowing in the fields and he's angry about it, and he looks at things and they explode in flames. So yeah, that's the one I want to have authoring my mystical book. So the Zohar is attributed to him. A lot of the scholarship suggests that the Zohar, like various mystical works, evolved in stages, and there is a core text that's original, and then there are layers and layers that were added on by students as this was being transmitted over time. Schools of Kabbalah, and I say schools, I don't mean school building, students, tuition, and so forth. What I mean is groups of sages who convene to discuss their ideas and develop a shared vision. Those schools of Kabbalah develop starting in the 13th century. They start recording ideas that had not been in text form until then. In eastern Spain, near the border of France, is one community. Another community is in Provence, in southern France. These sages are into more than just Kabbalah. They are well grounded in Talmud. They're well grounded in Jewish law. And they also are experts in mysticism. Some of them develop ideas that veer very dangerously towards what the mainstream considers heresy, and that causes some very interesting fights. We're going to talk about that a little bit in terms of where this goes, the concept of the Sefirot. We have to get to that. The big watershed moment for the development of modern Kabbalah comes in the 16th century. 15th into the 16th century, and the development of a community in Sfat, in Israel. Because that becomes really the source for much of what people think of as Kabbalah today. Some of the sages who were there, who were among the founders of the community, were Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, who I mentioned last week, Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, who is credited with writing the song Lecha Dodi, you may be familiar with from the Friday night davening. Rabbi Yosef Karo, also known as the author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Moshe Alshich, author of a classic commentary to biblical text. And then you get Rabbi Yitzchak Luria. Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, who is also known as the Ari, correct. Or the Ari Zal, as he's often identified, of Hending Zal, which just means Zichrono Livracha. His memory is for a blessing. He and then his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital. And the Ari really spreads and evolves the teachings of Kabbalah. He himself doesn't write it down. His student, Rabbi Chaim Vital, is the one who actually takes the step of committing this to writing. He talks about reincarnation, and not just reincarnation as an idea, but like he names names. Like so-and-so is a reincarnation of such and such, that kind of thing. Talks about the effects of our mitzvot, what happens when you perform a mitzvah, the ideas of kavanot and yichudim, if those words are familiar for some of you, literally what is kavanah? Intention, focus, direction, correct. But kavanot, as they use them, means what you're supposed to have in mind as you are engaged in a particular mitzvah. And the mystical effects of what you have in mind. Yichudim. Anybody know what yichudim are? You can't do it by translating the word. That won't help you on this one. Yichudim means reorganization of the letters of God's name in order to form other words that you recite in order to have an impact on higher spiritual realms. All of that springs from and is publicized from this school that's in Sfat. Now, Kabbalah goes through a bit of a downturn in the 17th century. Anybody know why? In the 1660s specifically. What's going on in the Jewish world in the 1660s? Not Hasidut. They're not around for another century. The false Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi. We've had numerous false messiahs down through the ages. right? There's one from about 2,000 years ago you may be familiar with. But there are all sorts of false messiahs through Jewish history, people who, in some cases, genuinely believed that they were the Messiah, and were not trying to take advantage of people. They really believed it. In other cases, people who, yeah, were taking advantage of the gullibility of those around them. But one of the ones who really stands out, perhaps the one who stands out even the most, is Shabtai Tzvi. And without going into his entire story, as fascinating as it is, in the 1660s, he convinces such a large swath of the Jewish people that he is Mashiach, the Messiah is here, that you find people who actually sell off their assets and buy trunks in which they store materials for their journey to Israel as they expect to be summoned there any day by the Messiah. He goes to the Sultan and says to him, I am the Messiah, and it is time for you to step off your throne. That doesn't work out. Just no. He ends up in prison where he suddenly discovers Islam. Yeah, really. It's a fascinating story, Shabtai Tzvi. Read up on it. But one of the contributing factors in this is the influence of mysticism. And so Shabtai Tzvi becomes this sort of lightning rod in which they say, well, if mysticism can lead to that, we don't want anything to do with Kabbalah. And especially because even after he converts to Islam, he still has Jewish followers who think he's the Messiah. He has now just gone to redeem the sparks that are in Islam. And eventually he's going to come back, they believe. And even after he's dead, there are still people who follow him. You've heard of the Frankists. The followers of Jacob Frank, which ended up being some kind of weird hybrid Jewish and Christian messianic group, after Shabtai Tzvi is gone, you're already in the 18th century. The result is that people want to stay far away from Kabbalah. They don't want anything to do with something that can lead to this kind of destruction. Until you get to the time of the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim at the end of the 18th century. With the development of the Hasidim, you find a great emphasis on the teachings of the Ari, of Rabbi Yitzhak Luria. We're not going to go into now all the discussion, which we should have at some point, about where Hasidim came from and so forth. But one of their main teachings is that there are sparks of holiness everywhere. You don't necessarily need to be a brilliant scholar of Torah in order to elevate the world around you. You can draw close to God and elevate these sparks just by engaging in holy activity in your normal daily life. Whether that's in terms of eating, whether that's in terms of getting together with friends, walking in the woods, whatever it is, all of these can be highly spiritual activities, and they draw on Kabbalah as part of this. And that's sort of one, and it's a very oversimplified presentation of it, but that's sort of one tack. And then on the other hand, interestingly, those who were known as the Mitnagdim. Mitnagdim literally means the opposition, which is a very good branding thing. If you ever want to start a movement, you know, that's a new movement, and you're worried about the fact that there are a lot of people who aren't on your side, what you do is you brand everybody else the opposition. Because now you're the mainstream. That's the way it works. So they are the Hasidim, and those who aren't Hasidim are the Mitnagdim. Those must be the opposition. Well, the Mitnagdim, headed in the beginning by the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, in Lithuania at the end of the 18th century, then by his student Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, who I mentioned last week, they also draw on mystical ideas, even as they emphasize developing knowledge of Torah and love of Torah. They're still drawing on mystical ideas. We're going to see a lot of it shortly when we get to our next topic of why we are here. So that you see development of Kabbalah return, even though it had been demolished at the end of the 17th century, by the end of the 18th, it's back. And it has been revived again since the middle of the 20th century, as people have gone looking for meaning, and as some of the sources of meaning that people found in science and intellectual development let people down in World War II, when the most advanced and civilized society turned out to be barbaric. So people went looking and said, well, there must be answers outside of science to what life is all about, what I'm supposed to be doing, because the intellect has let us down. And so you end up with a reassertion of mysticism in general and in Jewish circles in Kabbalah. And that's where I want to pause the discussion about the origins of Kabbalah. So what is Kabbalah? It's a received tradition that seeks to explain how the universe works on a spiritual level. It was kept out of, so to speak, mainstream Torah for a very long time. Although there are plenty of hints to it. And when I say mainstream, I really mean public. That's a better word, not mainstream. There are enough hints to it in public Torah along the way that we know that it was there, even though the books were not published. So that brings me to our second topic. We're now 25 minutes in, and now I'm up to week two. That doesn't bode well. Nonetheless...